You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from right across the street from the U.S. Supreme Court building. Today we're doing a radio row. We're going to have a variety of guests on the topic of what's going on before the Supreme Court right now, which is the debate about Obamacare and the so-called Affordable Care Act the so-called Obamacare. Actually, it's technically called the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, before we get into the details and the nitty-gritty of that, and, you know, a lot of our guests are going to do that, I wanted to talk with you about the whole idea of the Supreme Court making such a decision in the first place. This is a court that has gone off the rails. But here's the thing, the amazing thing, is it hasn't just gone off the rails recently. It went off the rails almost, 1803, 1903, over 200 years ago, in 1803. The Supreme Court, by declaring that they have the power to strike down laws passed by the president, has basically set themselves up as kings and queens, and nowadays, back in the day, it was just kings, for this country. Did the founders intend that 9 people on the Supreme Court, it's been various numbers at various times, it's been 7, it's been 5, but right now it's 9 people, that 9 people on the Supreme Court, did the founders intend that 9 people on the Supreme Court should have the power to strike down laws passed by Congress? Did the founders intend that Congress should have the law, the Supreme Court should have the power to strike down laws signed into law by the president? Actually, no. Not at all. This was debated in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention, and they explicitly decided not to give that kind of power to the Supreme Court. In fact, in Federalist No. 78, 1788, these were the papers, the Federalist Papers were written by John Jay, mostly by Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, and a few by John Jay and George Mason. And they were basically a sales job. They were trying to sell the Constitution to the American people. It took 2 years, from 1787 when it was written until 1789 when finally they had gotten ratification by enough states that they could say, okay, we've got a new country and George Washington's going to be our president. And that was in 1789, 2 years later. So in 1787, 1788, they published these series of what we call the Federalist Papers now. Back then, they were letters to the editor signed by Publius, by an anonymous source. And from Federalist number 78, here's what Alexander Hamilton wrote when reassuring the American people that the Supreme Court would never have the power to strike down laws, that the power to make laws would always reside with the lawmakers who are answerable to we the people. You can throw a lawmaker out on his butt. It's called an election. You can't throw a Supreme Court justice out on his butt. And that worried a lot of people. And they wanted to make sure that the Supreme Court was only the final appeals court, and that's it. In Hamilton and Federalist 78, you can read it yourself, he wrote, "The judiciary, from the nature of its functions, will always be the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution, because it will be the least in a capacity to annoy or injure them. The judiciary has no influence over either the sword or the purse." What he's talking about there, the sword, of course, is the executive branch. That's where all police functions are and military functions are. And the purse, of course, is Congress. Only Congress can appropriate or spend money or raise taxes. It's right there in, you know, Article 2, the executive branch, Article 1, the legislative branch of the Constitution. So anyhow, Alexander Hamilton says the judiciary, which is Article 3, the third of among equals, but actually the inferior of them. He says the judiciary has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction either of the strength or of the wealth of the society. In other words, they can't mess with our money. They can't make decisions like they're trying to make today, and can take no active resolution whatever. In other words, they can't make laws. It proves, Alexander Hamilton wrote in 1788, it proves, a year before we became a nation, it proves uncontestably that the judiciary is beyond comparison the weakest of the three departments of power, semicolon, that it can never attack with success either of the other two. So the Constitution says that the Supreme Court is the final court of appeals, So, like, if AT&T and Verizon had a series of lawsuits that went all the way up through the courts until they finally, you know, somebody finally has to say, okay, this is the final decision, end of the road. That's the Supreme Court. That's the role that the Supreme Court is given in the Constitution. That's it. And even that capacity can be regulated by Congress. As the Constitution says, Article 3, Section 2, you can read it in the Constitution. The Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, right, final appeals court, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as Congress shall make. In other words, they are subordinate to Congress. So how did they get the power to strike down laws and stop presidents? To become the unelected kings and queens of America, they took it onto themselves. In 1803, in a case called Marbury versus Madison, when Chief Justice Marshall announced that case, then President Thomas Jefferson went absolutely nuts. He said, as the Federalists say, the judiciary is the last resort in relation to the other departments of government, then indeed is our Constitution a complete felo de se, which is Latin for a suicide pact. He said, the Constitution on this hypothesis is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they may please. End of quote. But Jefferson couldn't contest that case because he had won it. Marbury versus Madison. James Madison was Jefferson's Secretary of State. Jefferson was the president in 1803. He won the case. You can't contest a case before the court that you just won. So he was stuck with it. It was like John Marshall figured out a way to get Jefferson and the nation. President Andrew Jackson, over the next 50 years, by the way, this was only used about a half a dozen times because of the public blowback. Andrew Jackson, for example, in 1832, this is 50 years into our republic, the Supreme Court, and again, this was John Marshall. He was still on the bench. John Marshall ruled that the state of Georgia couldn't seize Indian lands, and the state of Georgia was actively doing it, and the president, Andrew Jackson, was totally in favor of it. And so he said, and I quote, Chief Justice John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it. And he just completely ignored what the Supreme Court said. Lincoln took on the Supreme Court. Franklin Roosevelt took on the Supreme Court. As Newt friggin' Gingrich pointed out, clip number 3, Jacob. This is Newt Gingrich talking about this.
I'd ask, first of all, have they studied Jefferson, who in 1802 abolished 18 out of 35 federal judges? 18 out of 35 were abolished.
Something that was highly criticized.
Not by anybody in power in 1802. Jefferson himself was asked, is the Supreme Court supreme? And he said, that is absurd. That would be an oligarchy. Lincoln repudiates the Judge Scott decision in his first inaugural address in 1861 and says, no 9 people can make law in this country. That would be the end of our freedom. So I would suggest to you, actually, as a historian, I may understand this better than lawyers. And as lawyers, those two attorneys general are behaving exactly like law schools, which have overly empowered lawyers to think that they can dictate to the rest of us.
And he's absolutely right. It pains me to say Newt Gingrich is right, but he is. And he's not alone. This isn't a left or right thing. The dean of the Stanford Law School, a fellow by the name of Larry Kramer, has written an entire book about this called The People Themselves, which was the phrase Jefferson said, you know, after this Marbury decision, Jefferson said the power should be with the people themselves, not with the Supreme Court, to decide what is and isn't constitutional. If Congress passes a law that the people think is unconstitutional, they vote that Congress out and a new Congress comes in and repeals the law. That's the remedy. And that's what Abraham Lincoln was calling for when he said, you know, the Supreme Court should not have decided Dred Scott, should not have decided in 1856 that people are property, leading right straight to the Civil War. But right across the street from where I'm sitting right now, I mean, we're literally in the shadow of the Supreme Court building. They are going to decide the constitutionality of a law.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And they shouldn't have that power. But they do, so we'll talk about it.
And he really wants to tax you to death and to kill your granny, too. He's saying that on the TV, so by God, it must be true.
Yeah. Thank God for the Supreme Court, modest and high-minded sort. Never would rule us from the bench, hit us with a monkey wrench. Except when it comes to appointing a president for a democratic nation.
election's over now to Monster Corporation.
Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you live from right across from the Supreme Court. We're doing our Supreme Court radio row. Elizabeth Weidra is with us. She's the chief counsel for the Constitutional Accountability Society. The website is theusconstitution.org. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Your thoughts on what's going on across the street?
Well, today, you know, it's a big case. Today started out a little dry. It was a technical issue being argued today.
Whether the court had the right to hear this case at this time.
Exactly. But, you know, the big takeaway from today is that it doesn't look like the court is going to use this technical law, the Anti-Injunction Act, to delay ruling on the actual question of whether the Affordable Care Act is constitutional. It didn't seem like the justices were eager to go in that direction. Right. So I think we'll probably get a decision on the Affordable Care Act before the end of the Supreme Court term.
Okay. And the argument in that case was because most of these provisions don't go into, and certainly the mandate doesn't go into effect until 2014, the Supreme Court doesn't have the authority to be determining constitutionality, which frankly I don't think they have the authority to determine, period, but that's a whole I think Marbury was wrongly decided. I agree with Larry Kramer, the dean of the Stanford Law School, who wrote an entire book about this, the people themselves, and with Thomas Jefferson, and I guess with Newt Gingrich, that Marbury was wrong, but in any case, that's a whole other thing. So the court, you know, is just going to go ahead and they're going to say we can. Well, I mean, you've got, you know, Scalia and Thomas, who've already said they don't even have to hold themselves to the judicial code of conduct for federal judges. You know, sure, I'll go duck hunting with a plaintiff or a defendant actually before the court, and then rule. Why should they just, you know, let anything else stop them? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I think that that they're going to get to the merits of this, and I think Justice Scalia is going to have a hard time getting away from some decisions that he himself, opinions that he has written, that really support federal power in this case. And so I think that it's going to be very difficult for him to, in good conscience, get away from those rulings and rule against the mandate. So I think there's a reason to be hopeful that Justice Scalia might join with the more liberal justices and vote to uphold the individual mandate.
Well, and in this case, that has to do with the Constitution, or excuse me, the Commerce Clause.
Exactly.
And whether the federal government has the right to regulate commerce between the states, and Scalia has historically ruled in favor of more expansive federal authority vis-a-vis the Commerce Clause. You want to give us some examples of that?
Yeah. So it's been a mixed bag with him. Initially, he joined the ruling that said you can't have a federal ban on guns around schools based on the Commerce Clause.
Right.
But then he went in his most recent case, Gonzalez versus Raich, which involved a woman who was growing medicinal marijuana in her backyard for personal use, not going to sell it. It was fully in accordance with local law. He said that could be regulated under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. And I would say that, you know, someone who, you know, the uninsured who pass on about $43 billion in uncompensated care costs to other market participants, gosh, I mean, that seems like much more affecting interstate commerce than a woman growing medicinal marijuana in her backyard.
When the Supreme Court was upholding civil rights laws, they were saying things back in the 60s. They were suggesting, I forget the case, that because the Woolworths was serving ketchup that was made in Pennsylvania, they were engaged in interstate commerce at their lunch counter, even though they were just serving local people.
Right.
And, you know, which is kind of a stretch, but it worked for them.
Right.
Did Scalia say, I haven't read this case, did Scalia say that because she was growing the pot in a plastic container that was made in some other state? I mean, what was the basis to say that there was a Commerce Clause hook into this thing?
It's actually actually broader than that. He was saying that the marijuana that she was growing, while it was never intended to be in the market, was an instant from the market. That was the phrase he used.
So it could be sold.
Exactly. And, you know, that argument holds even more strongly with insurance. I mean, you're someone who doesn't buy insurance. You're not currently getting care.
Right.
But in an instant, you cross the street, get hit by a car. you could be in the insurance market, in the healthcare market, needing care that you can't pay for. So, you know, Scalia's own words are being used against him by the government.
Could it be that in that case, what he was just trying to do was look for any old excuse to maintain the illegality of pot?
Yeah.
And so he twisted his own logic?
That is the concern. I mean, you know, is it just because there are policy preferences? You know, he wants to keep drugs away. There's another case involving dangerous sex offenders. Or is he going to be true to his word? And that will be the case. And we'll be holding him accountable if he does not stay true to his word.
That's great. I you know, and thank you very much for showing up today and for the great work you're doing.
My pleasure.
Elizabeth Wydra, the chief counsel for the Constitutional Accountability Society, CAC, the USConstitution.org.
Exactly. Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Thanks very much for being with us today. Remarkable. And always good to know. Thank you. Always good to know the background of these things. I find this Scalia's involvement in this is going to be one of the most interesting things to watch over the next couple of days. Not to sound too much like a sportscaster or something, but I really think he's most likely going to be the swing vote. Although, you know, in fact, Kennedy has kind of already pre-signaled that he's not going to be. So we'll see how it shakes out. We'll see. We will see, as they say. It is 28 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you in Washington, D.C., in the shadow of the Supreme Court. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back right after this with Rick Unger, a columnist with Forbes and the Washington Monthly. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Rick Unger's on the line, or not on the line, he's sitting right here across
from me. Right here in front of you.
There you go, Rick. And great to have you with us. And Rick is a columnist for Forbes and the Washington Monthly and regularly pop up on Fox News and whatnot.
A token Libby on Fox News.
There you go. So, Rick, your take on what has happened so far?
I think so far, meaning this morning, has been fairly dull and predictable. There were a few interesting questions from the court.
One quick question, if I could. This is simulcast as TV on Dish Network.
Hello?
And TV, and with your hands right there, we can't see your face.
Terrible thing to do.
Okay. So,
as I was saying before I destroyed the video here.
Okay.
Basically, I mean, I think what the court's telegraphing is that they really don't intend to take advantage of the anti-injunction law, that they do intend to hear and decide all of the issues of the case.
Right.
What struck me was Justice Roberts, who had asked the question how this was in any way different than what had taken place back when Social Security was before the Supreme Court. And, in fact, it was a very similar situation. Mm-hmm. And I think he kind of drove home the point that this is not a big deal, what we saw this morning.
So was he also saying that this court will probably rule the same way they did in Social Security in 1937?
You never know. Justices have been known to ask questions when they really have something entirely different on their mind. But I think it's a fair conclusion that they do intend to do that. You never know. They could surprise us. They are the ultimate 800-pound gorilla. But I don't think this is going to be an impediment to going forward.
You also said during the break, you said that you thought the fourth issue,
Medicaid,
was the big sleeper. First of all, what are the four issues?
This morning was the first issue, which was whether or not they could even hear the case. It was ripe for adjudication based on a statute that's existed for a long time. I think it's probably fair to conclude that's not going to be an issue. Tomorrow morning is the second issue, which is the big mandate issue. Is it constitutional?
Right.
If they get past that, if the court were to decide, yes, indeed, it is constitutional, then you get to the third issue, which is, if they decide it's not constitutional, if they strike it down, you get to the third issue, which is, well, if we strike down the mandates, did Congress intend this law to continue to exist without the mandate?
Is it severable?
Right. Is it so critical that it has to be there? And that will be a very important issue if, in fact, they do strike down the mandates. There's a lot of different ways they can go with that. They can say no, they can say yes, they can come up with something in between. But the fourth issue is what's had my attention and been really very little discussion about it. And this is the challenge to the Medicaid part of Obamacare, which greatly expands the availability of Medicaid to a lot more people. The states are basically trying to argue that this is a federalist issue, that the government is attempting to tell them what they can and can't do within their states. At the same time, what they don't like is that what the government is saying is, you can do whatever you want, but we're not going to give you more money if you don't follow the law that we passed. Right. Now, backing up a little bit, the way Medicaid works, roughly 50% of every state's budget comes from the federal government. Along with that money comes certain guidelines. They've never called them rules, interestingly. They've always called them guidelines. But if you don't follow the guidelines, you don't get the money.
Right.
Now the states are saying, well, that's not fair. We want to get the money, but we want to do with it what we want, and we don't want to have to go along with this Obamacare stuff, but we still want the money.
Right.
And the government's saying, no, it doesn't work that way. So basically they are challenging the federal government's ability to put these constraints upon the states and still allow them to take the money.
But, I mean, that's just the same thing that Richard Nixon did with the Federal Highway Act when he said you're going to lower your speed limits to 55 to save gas. Jimmy Carter did the same thing, or maybe it sustained through the Ford and Carter administrations. I don't recall. And nobody ever made that chat. Well, I mean, they made that. They yelled and screamed, but it.
I hadn't thought of it, but that is actually a spot-on comparison. That's exactly right.
Yeah, and
that's exactly right.
And to the best of my knowledge, to this day, nobody has challenged the constitutionality.
Not that I can recall. No. I can recall. You know,
and maybe Nevada didn't take the money, or did they actually drop their speed limit for a while?
Well, they probably put it in the casino and figured it out.
There you go. Yeah. It all comes out in the end. Just tangentially, peripherally, I started the show with a 20-minute rant about the Marbury case and we no longer have and haven't really since, you could say 1803, but, you know, in the first 50, in 1832, Andrew Jackson challenged the Supreme Court in the Georgia case, and he said, John Marshall's made his decision, let him enforce it. And, of course, Marshall didn't have the means to, Hamilton had predicted in Federalist 78. But that there's just this giant power grab that the Supreme Court did in 1803 that, it wasn't really until after the Civil War they started seriously using constitutionality as a rubric to overturn laws and to play legislators. And they've hugely done it since the 1970s, since Lewis Powell was put on the court.
No question. That's exactly right. And we were talking during the break. It was one of the great power vacuums and one of the great power grabs of all time. Right. It absolutely changed the future of this country. And I don't see us ever going back.
Yeah, I don't either because, you know, stare decisis and momentum and what astounds me is I've written a book on legal issues, really on citizens, on the whole Santa Clara County and Citizens United stuff, and I go in and lecture at law schools, and I'll start out by saying, you know, everybody raise your hand who knows that, for example, in 1886 in Santa Clara County, corporations became people,
right?
And everybody will raise their hand. You know, professors, and the court didn't rule that in 1886. It's in the head note, but it's not in the ruling.
It was a clerk who ruled that.
That's right.
John
Chandler Bancroft Davis was the clerk.
Somebody who had a close relationship with a railroad company.
He was the president of
a
railroad company. Yeah. And I wrote the book that blew that out, you know. And
I actually didn't know that you wrote that book.
Yeah, on equal protection.
Great story.
And prior to that book coming out, I mean, everybody was saying, oh, yeah, it was, you know, this is stare decisis from 86. And no, sorry. No. And in fact, a whole long story about Caskey versus Nike. Basically, you know, we were able to deliver that message to Rehnquist, and I personally think that it so shocked him that the court said we granted cert inappropriately. I mean, all they did was pull cert. They said we shouldn't have heard this case. This is after arguments, after oral arguments, after, you know, everything.
Moral to the story: the Supreme Court does make mistakes.
Yeah. But, I mean, they've only done that, I think, five or six times in their history.
Yeah, it doesn't happen often, that's for sure.
So where do you think this is all going to go?
I think it's all going to have a happy ending, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I think it would be so shocking to me, as an attorney, aside from my real-life day job, to see this case go in any other direction. I cannot believe that they will strike down this law.
Yeah.
Everything we know about the history of each of the justices and what they've ruled, everything we know about every case that brings us to today, it just wouldn't make a lot of sense.
Well, and even if you were to use the theory that this is a highly partisan court, and that Thomas Scalia and Roberts in particular, and maybe Alito to some extent, are really running off a partisan agenda, you know, and you see that reflected in everything from Bush v. Gore forward, that even if you were to use that theory, by approving Obamacare as constitutional and saying, well, I'm sorry, there wasn't anything we could do about it, what they're doing is they're handing the Republicans this huge thing to run on in the election, whereas if they knocked it down, they take away one of the Republicans' issues.
It's fascinating. That's absolutely true. There are so many political sides to this. Have you ever considered what would happen if they do knock it down? What will the Republicans do then?
They'd freak out.
I am convinced they are sitting there praying every night, led by Rick Santorum, that Obamacare is found constitutional because they got nothing.
I know.
It's
the same thing with abortion and gun control.
And now we'll expect something.
Yeah, exactly. If any of these issues were ever resolved,
right,
suddenly the Republican Party would lose half
its
fundraising ability.
I think they're terrified that it could happen. I think the only thing allowing them to sleep at night is they know it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, something that's caught my attention, if you happen to see Chief Justice Roberts' State of the Judiciary a couple months ago, very interesting. He is very sensitive about what we're talking about. He spent most of the time talking about judicial impartiality.
He's taking a lot of heat for Citizens United.
At a
social level.
That's right. And you know what people don't think about? This court is called what? It's not called the Supreme Court. It's called the Roberts Court.
Right.
Every Supreme Court is named after the Chief Justice.
Right.
He does not want the Roberts Court going down in history as the political court. He is very worried about this.
That's very interesting.
And I think it will matter.
And he's young enough. I mean, he's
going to be around a while.
I don't know how old George Marshall must have been in his 30s when he was put on the court, or maybe his early 40s.
Maybe 40s.
Because he served on that court 36 years, I think.
Yeah.
It was a long time. And John Roberts certainly could be on this court for 30
years.
Absolutely
he could. No Chief Justice wants that. Yeah. To go by their name. And I think that Citizens United did shake him up. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
He has this on his mind.
Yeah.
And I think the rest of the court does, too, except for Thomas, who we know what he'll do.
Yeah, Thomas doesn't seem to much care about it.
He doesn't care.
Yeah, he's like, you know, well, I got
and
mine.
At least his vote will be consistent with his other votes, to be fair.
Right.
He will vote to strike this law.
Right. He's not been a friend of the Commerce Clause, like Scalia?
No, he's actually been far more restrictive than Scalia. I believe Scalia is going to vote to uphold it.
Yeah.
I think he almost has to.
He has to get around it.
Because
of the pot law, you know, pot decision, which was, like, arguably indefensible.
Exactly. And he went so far out on a limb with his opinion, shockingly so, but I think it's going to be very hard. He's clever enough to do it. If he really feels the need, he'll find a way around it.
Right.
But I don't think he's going to.
Yeah. That's it.
There goes my head. Just lost something.
Yeah, we just lost me. So we're just going to look at you, Rick. We're talking with Rick Unger, who is a columnist for the Forbes and the Washington Monthly, and we just have a few seconds left.
What shall we do with it? Expecting
any surprises tomorrow?
No, I'm really not. You know, I think when it gets to really critical issues like what's going to be heard tomorrow morning is, of course, the main attraction.
Right.
They're going to be minding their P's and Q's. They're going to ask some very impressive questions. You can expect that. Some searing. You can expect Justice Souter to throw some misdirection, as he likes to do. He'll make you think he's going one way when he may be thinking something entirely differently. It'll be good.
Good.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Rick Unger, columnist with Forbes, The Washington Monthly, Forbes.com, and Rick, website?
No. Actually, just go to Forbes.com.
Okay, you got it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from the shadow of the Supreme Court, right next door to the Supreme Court here in the United Methodist building of all, the religion I was raised in, of all things. Sitting right across from me is Congressman Robert Andrews, representing the 1st District of New Jersey, and ably doing so. Let me turn your microphone on, sir, here.
Thank you, Tom. That should work better. Good to see you here today. Glad you're here to cover the proceedings.
Thanks for joining us. I'm curious your take on the political implications of all this and the policy implications of it.
Well, the political implications are that 130 million voters should make this decision, not nine justices.
Oh, you agree with Thomas Jefferson on that?
I do. I'm a radical here. I actually believe in the primacy of elected people over appointed people.
Yeah.
So a truly conservative decision here would be to uphold the law and take it to the voters. And when we reelect the president, which I believe we will and should, and put the House back in Democratic hands, which I believe we will and should, and keep the Senate in sort of Democratic hands. I believe we will and should. Let the voters make this decision, not nine unelected people. That's the truly conservative position here.
Well, it's also the constitutional position. I mean, Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution says the Congress shall operate under rules prescribed by Congress. And, you know, Congress actually has the authority right now, for example, to say to Thomas and Rehnquist, Scalia, you guys have to operate under the judicial code of conduct that applies to all of the federal judges. Any idea why Congress hasn't done that?
Well, I signed a letter that said that Justice Thomas should have recused himself from this case. I mean,
right.
I don't mean any assault on his personal integrity, but here's the facts. Justice Thomas's wife has earned a significant amount of money.
We're talking well over $500,000.
Yeah, where I come from, that's really significant.
Yeah.
And working for groups that were formed to oppose the health care law. So I think the idea of Justice Thomas participating in this decision is wrong, and I'm one of the signatories, as I said, that said he should have recused himself.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure the reason he didn't is that his vote's probably pretty much decided here, and it's the wrong way.
Yeah, that he's going to say no to this. You heard my commentary with a caller a little earlier where I was suggesting that if the Supreme Court were to knock down Obamacare, which, you know, thankfully the administration is now calling it that. I've always thought he should get credit for it. If they knock it down, they're going to leave the Republicans in the lurch. I mean, you know, they're raising a lot of money and pushing their candidates, you know.
All right, well, the first thing I do when elected president or to Congress is to repeal Obamacare
on this issue. So there is a political dimension to it. On the other hand, you want, you know, if they struck it down, I mean, it would be a bad thing for the country, but it would be a worse thing for the Republican Party. I just can't imagine any scenario where they're going to strike this thing down. Or am I missing something altogether?
I don't know. I don't want to forecast what they'll do, but I know who this would hurt if they struck it down.
Yeah.
It's the children with juvenile diabetes that couldn't get health insurance because of pre-existing conditions.
2.5 million kids, yeah.
It's the millions of senior citizens that have to pay thousands of dollars out of their pocket for prescription drugs.
Yeah.
It's the small business people have gotten tax cuts to provide health insurance for their employees. You know, I don't know about the political machinations. I know this law is good for this country, and it's long overdue. And it's the best path to get 35 million people health insurance who do not have it today. And I think for this court to disregard the will of the legislative branch and the president is wrong. And look, if the public doesn't want this law, there's an election coming in November.
Mm-hmm.
The public will make that view known. I happen to think that that's not what's going to happen. I think the president's going to be reelected, and I think the law will survive. But again, that decision, Tom, should be made by 130 million voters, not nine judges.
Amen. Amen. And, you know, as Jefferson said when the Marbury versus Madison case happened in 1803, and the court took onto itself the power to declare the constitutionality of things, which is not given to it in the Constitution.
But, you know,
but that's another
argument.
This
is really not Marbury versus Madison. This is the Schechter-Poultry case for your lawyer listeners that, you know, when President Roosevelt and others tried to institute the New Deal to lift the country out of the Great Depression, we had a conservative majority on the Supreme Court that cited cases like Schechter-Poultry that struck down the New Deal.
Yeah.
And eventually what happened is that I think the public uproar became so significant that they realized that whether they liked it or not, Franklin Roosevelt was the president of the United States.
Well, I think in 1936 when he tried to change the number of when he tried to say using Article 3, Section 2, that any justice over 70 years old became a justice emeritus, and in aggregate all of them would represent one vote, and there were four guys on the court who were over 70, or maybe five. You know, people call it court packing. I'd say it's re-regulated.
I'm not suggesting we do that, but I do think that these justices, some of them are cognizant of the fact that they're not living in a vacuum here. They're living in a political context where millions of people have the right to vote on this question, and they will vote. And I'm very confident that they're going to vote to reelect a president who signed this bill.
Yeah. Well, and that speaks to the point of if this is upheld, and if the Republicans run to their base on the argument of we're going to repeal Obamacare, I think the majority of Americans, like you said, who realize that there's value in this to them, if the administration and the Democratic Party can sufficiently, adequately, appropriately message that, people are going to be with the Democrats.
The people this country care most about jobs. The reality is the month the president took office, the country lost 700,000 jobs. The president has overseen policies that have added 3.9 million private sector jobs to the economy. That's the Democratic record on jobs. The Republican record is 8 million jobs lost under George Bush.
Right.
That's going to determine the election. I wouldn't want to talk about that either if I was the Republicans,
sure.
Which is why they're talking about just about anything else, including forcing medical procedures on women.
Right.
That's a winning issue for them. Let's hope they keep talking about that.
And Limbaugh. Although the weird thing is that apparently a disproportionate number of Republican or kind of Fox News Republican voters.
It's redundant.
Now think that Obamacare is only about whether or not women have a right to contraception, which is bizarre.
You know what? Let them think what they want to think. That we respect everybody, we don't call people names, and we stand for the constitutionality of this law, and we're going to make sure it stays.
Congressman Robert Andrews,
thanks, Tom.
Great job. Thank you very much
My
for dropping
pleasure.
By today.
Thank you.
Pleasure meeting you, sir. Thank you.
My privilege.
We will be back in just a few minutes here with more from right across the street from the Supreme Court here on the Tom Hartman Program.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Here's your factoid for the day. 130 million. That's the number of Americans who right now have a pre-existing condition. 130 million Americans. Right now, under Obamacare, all kids with pre-existing conditions are covered. But soon, under Obamacare, about a year and a half, everybody who has a pre-existing condition will be able to get health insurance or health care. This is a big deal. This is, as Joe Biden would call it, a BFD. And so the question, is the Supreme Court going to strike this thing down? Time will tell. The next couple of days, in all probability, will give us a really solid indication. Stephen in Gainesville, Florida, listening at 5:40 a.m. Hey, Stephen, what's on your mind today?
I called because conservatives continue to rail against Obamacare because of the mandate, the federal mandate that everyone must buy health insurance.
Right.
So I called 58 different Republican representatives today throughout the Congress and the Senate to find out their stance on the 1986 law that federal government mandated that all hospitals see patients regardless if they can repay for services.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't received any, nobody had anything to say about it. They all said that, oh, we would get back to you or shoot us an email and we'll email you something back. And
wait a minute, Stephen, tell me about this. I'm not familiar with it. Tell me, please.
Well, there's a federal law. There's a federal mandate that was passed in 1986. I can't remember the full name of it. It had something to do with the labor law. And it stated that the federal that anyone that was running a hospital could not.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. This was Reagan signed this into law, and it was part of. I thought it was part of a budget act. It was.
That's right.
It was a piece of.
It's federally mandated that they can't turn you away at a hospital. If you walk in there with a broken arm or something, that they can't say, "Well, how do you plan to pay for this?" and walk away. Well, to me, that's the same exact thing as a federal mandate. It says that everyone has to buy health insurance. As a matter of fact, to me, this is one of the reasons that causes the cost of health care to go up when everyone who doesn't have insurance just goes into the hospital because they have a cold or what have you, and then they can't repay the debt, which causes the health care cost to go up. So I'm curious as to why it is Republicans aren't up in arms against this federal mandate.
Right.
And so it's one of the reasons why I left the Democrat Party, the Democratic Party, was because I don't feel the Democrats have a backbone any longer. And so I also called Democrats today to, why aren't Democrats bringing this up? I mean, this is another federal mandate that Republicans have nothing to say about.
And you're hearing what?
I'm hearing, oh, that's a good point, and one
wish we thought
was
of
really
it.
Funny. It was really kind of sad because one person actually told me that it was too simplistic of an idea, and I said, remember, you're dealing with the American people here. Keep it really simple. But the reason I called, because I'm sure you would agree that people, in that federal mandate as well, is for people to call representatives, anybody you can, and ask them why they, you know, what they feel about this and where there's a stance on this. And the main reason is I'm hoping that it will get out there so that, you know, people like yourself or people who are in other news outlets will actually ask people when they come on, you know, mm-hmm. what do you feel about this? I mean, it is a federal mandate, and if it is against the Commerce Clause, then why, now that Citizens United was enacted, a hospital has the same rights as I have as a,
right.
as a human.
It's a corporation.
So because that corporation has the same rights, why are they having to, you know,
sure.
heal somebody without having to worry about getting paid?
That's a good one.
I'm hoping that Democrats will at least bring this up and have a backbone about it.
Okay. Stephen, thank you very much, and thanks
thank
for reminding
you.
Me of that. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot for the call. Martin in Washington, New Jersey. Martin?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, what's up?
I was just wondering, if Jefferson was so outraged, why didn't he introduce a constitutional amendment stating the Supreme Court cannot determine the constitutionality of the law?
When Marbury versus Madison was passed, he was, well, first of all, I don't think that he, in his wildest dreams, believed that things would end up where they've ended up. Hey, you want to hop on the air right now? Put those headphones on, and Congressman Dennis Kucinich just joined us. And, in fact, Martin, thanks a lot for the call. Let me ask the Congressman Kucinich, maybe he would like to get in on this as well. We've been talking about Marbury versus Madison and how Thomas Jefferson was so upset when the Supreme Court took onto itself the power to strike down laws based on constitutionality. And the caller was, why didn't Jefferson try to propose a federal constitutional amendment? Because Article 3 does not give the Supreme Court this power. And my take on it was based on his letter to Spencer Roane in 1819, where he said, you know, the people will eventually rise up against this, that he just expected that the American public would, you know, if the Supreme Court was to overreach again like that. And, you know, in the 36 years he was on the bench, John Marshall only resorted to using constitutional arguments, I believe, two or three times. It just wasn't done in the first 50 years of the Republic. 1832, Andrew Jackson was president, and he said John Marshall's made his decision in the case of the Cherokee Indians. He said, let him enforce it. In other words, he ignored the Supreme Court. But I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Congressman, but I'm also curious about your thoughts on, you know, what's before the court right now.
Tom, I think we're in an era where the Supreme Court can take up pretty much anything it wants and not have to worry about any precedent that would stop it.
Yeah.
The only thing we could look at with respect to this particular bill is whether or not the Supreme Court will duck it and say that the Injunction Act prohibits them from taking up the question because there's a tax that doesn't go into effect until 2015, and that's the time it would be appropriate to rule. But I think the bigger question that you raise is the proper role of the Supreme Court. And one of the things, when we look at the constitutional history of this country, with a tripartite government, we have really journeyed from the Jeffersonian model.
Mm-hmm.
In as much, not only with respect to the judicial branch overreaching, but also with respect to the executive branch overreaching. And the one branch that was first among equals, the legislative branch, actually ends up being the weakest branch in the 21st century.
Yeah, and that's truly bizarre, because that was where all power was supposed to reside, because that's the branch that every 2 years is answerable to the people.
That's right. Article 1, Section 8 makes it very clear that Congress has retained powers. And even there's powers that aren't expressed that are included in Congress's role. But this particular decision that will come down on affordable health care will determine, frankly, whether or not Congress has the ability to even regulate the insurance companies. Because that's how I see the Affordable Health Care Act, not as a mandate so much as a regulation of the insurance companies.
Right. One of the things that's built into the Affordable Care Act is the ability of states to develop their own systems. Not until 2017. Vermont's trying to get a waiver on this right now. You, back in 2004, I believe it was, in that race, coined the phrase Medicare Part E. I quoted you on that in my book, Rebooting the American Dream, in a chapter called Medicare Part E, and tried to give you as much credit as I could for that. E for everybody. In other words, let's just lower the eligibility age down to zero.
Right.
And apparently Vermont is, you know, they're moving ahead with this.
Vermont's moving ahead, and of course I'm grateful for your remembering that. We have an opportunity, or if the Supreme Court overturns this law, to begin again the discussion about universal, single-payer, not-for-profit health care, Medicare Part E for everyone.
Right.
And hopefully that would be a paradoxical good outcome if the Supreme Court knocks the affordable health care law down.
Well, and if they don't knock it down, then it's just a matter of time.
Right? I think that's right. I believe the same thing, Tom.
It's either going to be 2017 or somebody's going to get a waiver after the election.
It'll happen at a state level first, I believe.
Yeah, I think so, too. And of course, that's the Canadian history, isn't it?
Yes. Canada eventually had all the provinces say, oh, we want that, too, when you had one province. Saskatchewan had a breakthrough.
Yeah, and started that, and it was... wasn't that like a relative of Dennis and Kiefer Sutherland? Wasn't it like his?
I understand that.
I don't remember. But anyhow, Congressman Dennis Kucinich with us here. Am I hearing the music in the background? I am. Sometimes it's tough doing a remote. We'll be back in just a moment. Stick around. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You know that I can go to somebody. Let's see if we've got any calls there. Someone like you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Congressman Dennis Kucinich here with us. Let's pick up a few phone calls and see, you know, hopefully people have questions that the Congressman would like to address. Bill in Clifton, New Jersey, listening on WWRL in New York City. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. It always seems to be with the right wing that it's money over morality, and I don't understand the way they put it in terms of the... In terms of the healthcare thing that they want to strike down, why is it also not going to strike down the selective service where you are guaranteed you have to give
there's another mandate. In other words, if we're going to go after one, why not go after all of them? Bill, thank you for the call. Congressman, your thoughts?
Well, I think the Obama administration will be arguing that this is not a mandate. It simply seeks to regulate the consumption of health care.
Right.
And so the caller, though, raises the question about when government can do something that is truly coercive that might have a minimum of benefit to the society, it seems to be able to move forward with that. And when something has a great benefit to the society, the private interests will challenge the government. So it's a thought worth pondering.
We had a caller earlier who said that he has been calling his Republican, he said he called something like 40 members, Republican members of Congress, and said, if you're so opposed to mandates, why don't you oppose the 1986 mandate that Reagan signed into law that forces all hospitals to take anybody who shows up in their ER? And, you know, why isn't this an interference in you know, this is local commerce, arguably.
Congress certainly does have a role in being able to legislate on matters affecting the health and welfare of the American people. The question that the Supreme Court's going to have to decide, is the Affordable Care Act representing an impermissible intrusion on the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, or... on the other hand, is it an appropriate exercise of the regulatory function of Congress to be able to regulate the consumption of health care? Because that is the underlying issue here. That's why we came through with the Affordable Health Care Act, because people who go without insurance, as Walter Dellinger has pointed out, often shift the cost of their health care to other patients and taxpayers.
Right.
And
right.
These are some of the considerations which I think the court will have to ponder.
Yeah, Larry in Williamsburg, Iowa, you're on the air with Tom Hartman and Congressman Kucinich.
Yeah, my mother got a letter the other day from the Democratic National Committee Medicare Task Force, and it was a letter that explained all kinds of different things for women over 65 and how this new health care law was going to help. My mother was just tickled to death when she read it. She thought it was great. Until I told her what the Republicans want to do, and boy, she was adamant. She was really mad. And, you know, I don't know if everybody's getting this letter or, you know, just certain people or not, but
yeah.
This is something maybe they ought to do is get, you know, they should have been doing is sending letters out to
Yeah,
to
good
people.
Point, Larry. Larry, thank you very much for the call. Congressman, this really speaks to the issue of messaging and how relatively incompetent the Democratic Party over the last couple of years has been on messaging. I mean, you know, your caucus, the Progressive Caucus, came out with a great budget. You know, Jan Schakowsky was out there. She's on our program about it. You've been on talking about it. It was a budget that's far better than anything that Paul Ryan has ever come up with. Why isn't the message getting out? Is it that the media is more friendly to the Tea Party and more hostile to progressive voices?
You have to remember that the health insurance company's $86 million attack against affordable care has had some headlong momentum, mm-hmm. as well as the talking heads who are the adherents of that particular thinking that says that health care doesn't really have a place in the public good. It's only if you can afford to pay for it should you right. be entitled to it.
Right.
So the lack of the Democrats' effectiveness in being able to get the message out must be taken in consideration of how much money has been spent to try to overcome the public-spirited nature of the act.
And you know where almost every penny of that $86 million ended up was with the radio or television station.
And
are they going to give the coverage
and guess
to?
Guess where almost every penny of that money came from? Premiums, my friends.
Right. So we are paying to have the insurance companies run ads on our media that cause the media to say, gee, we're only going to pay attention to the message of the health insurance companies.
So that the insurance companies can keep taking American consumers over the coals. They have quite a system set up, which is why no matter what happens at the Supreme Court, inevitably we're going to have to work to break the hold which the insurance companies have on our health care system through eventually having a not-for-profit health care system.
That's amazing. It's like it puts the Ponzi in Ponzi scheme or something. I mean, there's got to be some
it puts the Z in it.
Yeah. We just have a minute to the break here to the bottom of the hour, not enough time to bring in another caller. Congressman, what are the projects that you're working on right now that you are really passionate about?
Well,
my
staff and I have met today. We're going to revisit this whole issue of health care and bring in not just the affordability of it, but the alternative nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk more about that another time. Monetary reform, my NEED Act, National Employment Emergency Defense Act, would make it possible for the government to use the same power the Federal Reserve uses right now, except we're going to do it to create jobs.
Hmm.
Also, a bill to effectively regulate genetically modified organisms,
mm-hmm.
Working with people in California right now and supporting their efforts to try to label GMOs. I mean, there's a passing, trying to get attention of the Congress for a Department of Peace Act,
mm-hmm.
so that we can work on a local level to make peace an organizing principle in our society and blocking a war in Iran. I mean, I've got enough to do between now and January 2nd when my term is finished.
That is a lot. That's an extraordinary list. And I wish you well on every single one of them. If there's anything that we can do to help you in regard to any of this.
Thanks, Tom. And the website is Kucinich.us, Kucinich.us for more information. Thank you. Good to be here.
Kucinich.us. Thank you, Congressman Kucinich. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back in just a few minutes here on the Tom Hartman Program, live from the shadow of the Supreme Court here in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with more news of the day in your calls right after this. Stick around. Tom Hartman.
I am the captain of a health insurance company. I plunder and I profit as I sail the corporate sea. My salary's in the millions and my dividends obscene. My logo is the Jolly Roger on a field of green.
His logo is the Jolly Roger on a field of green.
That's great. That's a great bumper, Jacob. Thank you very much. Good work. Barry, listening to us on WCBT in Chicago. Hey, Barry, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I'm a physician in the Chicago area,
mm-hmm.
and I'm extremely conflicted about the Affordable Health Care Act and the situation in the Supreme Court right now. In fact, it is just frustrating to me that, first of all, that it's even being considered in this context. We have to be having...
Barry?
Barry, yeah. I think either you've got the world's longest click on a call waiting or your phone is breaking up.
Oh, I'm here. I'm sorry.
Okay. See, so you were saying. You dropped a few words there.
Sorry. Anyway, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, we shouldn't be having to go through all of this. The healthcare industry, the insurance industry, should be regulated in any case. But
sure.
The problem with this act is, the Affordable Health Care Act, is obviously, you know, it's giving in to the, you know, healthcare insurance industry, and it's sort of exacerbating the situation of money laundering that's going on while creating a larger sort of bureaucracy, as the conservatives say, to be regulated in the insurance industry. And I am very skeptical as to how this regulation, you know, is going to be enforced.
It's, and much like Dodd-Frank, I mean, an awful lot is going to depend on whether Congress funds enforcement or decides to defund enforcement, and whether the executive branch, you know, how hard they're willing to fight. And if we end up with a Republican Congress, or if we end up with a Republican executive, you know, Mitt Romney as president, for example, even if the Affordable Care Act is sustained by the Supreme Court, things are going to get a whole lot worse for Americans who want health care. On the other hand, I share your ambivalence about this law. I was not a big fan of it originally because I wanted the public option, the public option to be Medicare Part E. Medicare Part AA. Anybody or AB. Anybody can buy it, right? If you're going to have a health insurance exchange, that didn't happen. That would be a public option. That didn't happen. But I do think that the door that it opens for individual states, we have two states now, it's Vermont and I believe it's Montana, one of the kind of mid-mountain western states has also expressed an interest in going their own way and setting up their own single-payer system within the state. And I think that those are good starts. But, you know, we are the only nation of the 34 most developed nations in the world that allows for-profit insurance companies to even do business in its country. So, Barry, have you been in practice long enough to remember what medicine was like before the Reagan administration, when most states, I believe all states, but I know most states, required health insurance companies to be not-for-profit entities?
Yes, I was actually training during that time, doing my surgical training during that time. And so I came out right when that was beginning to change. And it certainly changed the face of medicine, and it changed the sort of the motivation and medical care and the way that clinics and things were set up in general in terms of volume.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it
absolutely.
Sort of changed into a factory sort of mentality, which is still alive and well today. And unfortunately, you know, this bill doesn't go anywhere towards changing that.
Yeah, and that seems to me like a huge deal. I mean, I've owned businesses back in the 70s and 80s where we gave all of our employees health insurance because it was easy. I mean, you know, I remember back in the late 70s, Blue Cross Blue Shield in Michigan, my recollection is I was paying $35 per employee per month. And I know it wasn't more than 100 or so in the early 80s in Atlanta. But they were nonprofit companies that we were dealing with. Now, you know, you're looking at insurance premiums, you know, if the employer's picking up the whole thing, of anywhere from $500 to $1,000 per person / family, and it's just nuts. In some cases, a lot more than that.
It's very unfortunate. I mean, that's why I like listening to your show, Tom, because you tend to be optimistic and very reasonable, but I don't see this bill really changing that much in regards to people having to pay. It's just the government's going to help them pay. So
no, I agree with you, Barry, but here's what's happening. And this is kind of the inexorable arc of history. You know, Martin Luther King famously said the arc of history always, you know, may be long, but it always bends toward justice. We're seeing over time here, from the founding of this country, gays had no rights, women had no rights, African Americans had no rights, in fact, negative rights, you know, and all of these things have arced, have changed, and not fully, but, you know, they're all moving in the right direction. And the idea that that healthcare should be a right and not a privilege, you know, was something that, you know, was largely unheard of, you know, as in that kind of language until the time of the Franklin Roosevelt administration. And then it kind of, after Harry Truman proposed it in 46, or 47, it got shot down by Congress. It's pretty much stayed dormant until now. And I think that even if this law does nothing other than begin the conversation, that a decade from now, this country, you know, assuming that we can hold some sort of a progressive, you know, toehold, and I think that that's, maybe I'm an optimist, but I think that that's a given. I think too many people have been awakened by this, not for it to go forward, and that this is just a start. It's just a very humble start. It was the best that the president could get through Congress, where he didn't even really have a Democratic majority in the Senate. He had, you know, people like Ben Nelson in the Senate, and you know, Mary Landrieu and Blanche Lincoln and whatnot, and he pulled it off. So I'm actually an optimist. It's not that I'm like a congenital optimist. I mean, I'm just looking at the history of this country. It's a history of steady progress.
Well, so. I use that movement every day, Tom, to try to convince my patients about this bill and regarding the need for progression to Medicare for all. And I think that makes a pretty strong case for it, actually, what's happening with this bill.
Yeah, so I think so, too.
I agree that people are starting to understand that, and that is definitely a good thing.
Yep, and it begins the conversation. Barry, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to Chicago's Progressive Talk. I appreciate it. And good on you. You've got some very fortunate patients there to have a physician as enlightened as you. Jackie in Napa, California. Hey, Jackie, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Oh, hey, Tom, thank you very much. I've got a little comment and a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
The little comment is that it occurs to me that the Supreme Court actually did a coup in this country.
Yes, of
and
course.
Took over our republic. We had no time to deal with that because we were attacked in 2001 and brought immediately into a world war. And then their coup d'etat was the Citizens United.
I don't disagree at all with that analysis.
Okay, and here's the thing. Since 2000, since the attack in 2001, we have been in, as a people, as a nation, a complete information blackout with only the propaganda machine working. There are only two stations with people who have the money for $90 or more a month to pay. That's Free Speech TV and one other channel, Link. And that's the only two you can get any truth out of. So Americans are not stupid because they want to be. They're not ill-informed because they want to be ill-informed.
Yeah.
They are ill-informed because the Supreme Court has decided that that is their job, is to ill-inform us.
Yeah, that money is speech, not property, and that corporations are people, not phantoms of the law. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think, and thank you, Jackie, for the call, and thanks for sharing that. And I think Congressman Kucinich really said it brilliantly, pointing out that $86 million was spent by the health insurance industry in advertising on television and radio stations, you know, to trash Obamacare. $86 million bucks ended up in the coffers of radio and TV stations. And they look at $86 million and go, huh, who are we going to give the coverage to? And I guarantee you tomorrow you're going to see a lot of coverage of the Tea Party and the right-wingers, because that's who's paying the bill at the radio and TV stations. It's really simple. It's math. Betty in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. Hey, Betty, what's up?
Thank you so much, Tom, for taking my call. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I call in regarding your referencing of Kiefer Sutherland's relative.
Mm-hmm.
It was his grandfather, Tommy Douglas.
Uh-huh.
Who started the single-payer system. I want to say, if my memory serves me correctly, I believe it was in Saskatchewan and that it was
begun. Yes, I know it was Saskatchewan, so that would have been probably his maternal grandfather?
Yes, it was. I want to say that Donald Sutherland's first wife, I believe it was Shirley Douglas. I'm not positive. Shirley Douglas was her. I'm fairly certain that was her first name.
Yeah.
Tommy was her father, and yes, henceforth the grandfather to Kiefer.
Remarkable.
You can see his speeches. If I'm not mistaken, you can go into YouTube. His impassioned speeches, and they were just that, advocating on behalf of health care for all and how everybody was deserving of it. He was a wonderful politician.
Tommy Douglas is kind of a national hero in Canada.
Absolutely. And the other thing I want to thank you profusely for having for lauding at every possible time you're able to the accomplishments of Congressman Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah.
He, in my mind, is a national treasure.
He is, and I guarantee you that in January when his term runs out, you ain't seen the last of him. I mean, I have no idea what his plans are, but I just know him well enough to know you ain't seen the last of him.
I hope you're absolutely right about that because he's a true treasure.
Yeah,
thank
you very much, Betty. I appreciate the call. And of course, if I have anything to say about it, you haven't seen or heard the last of him because he's always got an open door here. We'll be back in just a few minutes here on the Tom Hartman Program with more of your calls. It need not be on health care or the Supreme Court, although I would love if any lawyers want to call and can try to convince me that judicial review and judicial supremacy are good things in the United States, bring it on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, too, right after this and find out what's going on in the world. Stick around. You mean two? I've actually got a... Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ron Pollock, who is the grand poobah, the big cheese, founding executive director? That's your official title. That's kind of cool. Of FamiliesUSA.org. And if you want to learn more about the Affordable Care Act, check out FamiliesUSA.org. And Ron, you were just sitting down a minute ago when I was talking with a caller and who was asking, what are the ways that Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act is bending the cost curve, is reducing the cost of health care for all Americans? My two guesses were the medical loss ratio, 80-20, and pulling out, taking Medicare Advantage, that privatized part of Medicare, and making it public so that the health insurance companies can't make so much profit off it. But I'm sure that there's got to be more to it than that.
There are lots of different ways. Focusing in on one of the key issues before the Supreme Court that relates to your question, those of us who have insurance pay a significant amount of money to pay for the uncompensated health care costs of those who don't have insurance.
Uh-huh.
So when somebody who can afford health insurance decides not to buy it, but then all of a sudden they've got a major illness or accident, we wind up paying for it. Let me give you an example of this. This is just it's a wonderful story. Mary Brown is the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. She lives in Florida. She and her husband decided, we don't want insurance. We'll pay for it on our own. Well, lo and behold, her husband needed significant health care, and she had bills, the family had bills in North Florida, Alabama, and Mississippi, hospitals and physicians, and they couldn't pay for it. And they declared bankruptcy. So they shifted.
Now, wait a minute. This is the woman who's suing the president whose case has come to the Supreme Court saying,
yes,
we don't want
is.
No stinking Obamacare?
Yes, it is. So she declared bankruptcy, which she's entitled to do.
Right.
But when she did, her bills didn't get paid. So who winds up paying for them? The government pays for some of them. We all pay for it when we have insurance.
Right.
The average added cost to pay for the uncompensated health costs of the uninsured for our insurance bills when we buy family coverage is more than $1,000 a year.
So
whoa. When you ask the question, what are we doing about costs? When we get more people covered, we won't have that surcharge in effect in our premiums.
Right.
That's going to be very helpful. So that's number one. Number two, as you indicated, there is this thing called medical loss ratios, and you were explaining it. It's the portion of the premium that actually goes for health care, as opposed to things like administrative costs, marketing and advertising, agents' fees, and profits.
Well, and bonuses for the CEO, and gold-plated toilet fixtures for the corporate jet.
Of course. And so now the Affordable Care Act requires that there be significant medical loss ratios so that the overwhelming majority of our premium dollars actually go for care.
It's 80%.
Some of the waste,
yeah.
Well, it's 80% for small insurance pools, 85% for the larger insurance pools.
Oh, even better.
So this is an improvement. But there are other things. The Affordable Care Act helps to promote evaluations about different types of clinical treatments to see which are working better than others.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there not to dictate what kind of health care we get, but to inform doctors and to inform patients about which therapies make most sense. A lot of these therapies are wasteful.
Right.
Well, it's not telling, again, the doctor or the patient, you can't get this care, you can't get that care. But I think as we learn which things are really going to be helpful clinically and which things are not, we're not going to waste resources in ways that a lot of us do. There's going to be much more coordinated care. The vast preponderance of health care costs in America for people who've got multiple chronic health conditions. But the problem is we don't have a coordinated care system.
Mm.
And so you go to, say, five specialists for five different chronic illnesses, and nobody's coordinating the care. And what one doctor is prescribing may actually counteract problems in another chronic condition. So now there's going to be a whole lot more coordinated care. That's going to be very helpful.
And then there's always the issue of it's a hell of a lot cheaper to do a mammogram and catch something quickly than to deal with a stage four cancer.
Absolutely. And that's a very important point, because what the Affordable Care Act does is it now provides free preventive care services. So you can get an annual checkup, you can get various tests. So that instead of going to an emergency room a few months down the road or an illness spreads and heroic intervention is necessary, you can learn about, this is good care,
right,
and it means that you're avoiding huge expenses later on.
Right. So things like mammograms and colonoscopies and just screening for hypertension, high blood pressure, where are your triglycerides or whatever. I don't know what all of those things are. you know this stuff better.
Yeah, and if you have diabetes, you want to check your blood
sugar and
make sure that there are adjustments if necessary.
Yeah. So the Affordable Care Act provides for all of these things. In the 30 or 40 seconds we have left, what's the most important thing that people can do right now to help make this law, keep this law and make this law better?
Well, there are two things. First, as you get help, and lots of people are already getting help through the Affordable Care Act, talk about it publicly.
Hmm.
Because when people hear about that, they can then relate to that, how that's going to affect their families.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we think this is a teaching moment. We want people who've already gotten help, or doctors and nurses who have seen their patients get help. It's very important to make sure people understand that. And the other thing is, we've got to make sure that state by state the Affordable Care Act is implemented effectively.
Right.
And it's going to be different in the 50 states. This is not a cookie-cutter type system. And so all of you can participate in some ways to make sure that your state is implementing this
law
in
an effective
manner.
Talk to your state legislators, make sure that they're doing it, rather than obstructing it as we're seeing in a few states, tragically.
Right.
Ron Pollack, he is the founding executive director of FamiliesUSA.org. If you want to know anything about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, get over to FamiliesUSA.org. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from Washington, D.C. Yeah, there I am. Hello. Oh, my. The Affordable Care Act argued today before the United States Supreme Court, and we'll see where that goes. We'll definitely see where that goes. There's also a number of other interesting things going on in the news that I just very quickly wanted to share with you, if I may, and if my computer will cooperate. It is suddenly running very, very slow. That's interesting. Anyhow, I've talked about this a number of times. We were talking about this in the context of Trayvon Martin, that this whole giant fear machine that is Fox News, right-wing talk radio, right-wing media, just, you know, the whole be afraid, has claimed another life. A 32-year-old mother of five, her name was Fatima El-Hamadi. She was an Iraqi immigrant fleeing the horrors of Iraq, living in California, was found beaten to death. Actually, when they found her, she was still breathing, but she was laying in a pool of her own blood. Somebody had beaten her unconscious with a tire iron and put a note next to her that said, "Go back to your country, you terrorist." And they put her on life support and ultimately pulled the plug, and she died. And meanwhile, Fox so-called news just going, you know, like the Energizer Bunny on this thing. It's just incredible. Here's statistics, interesting statistics. The Supreme Court, is debating the constitutionality of Obamacare. Meanwhile, over on the Republican side of things, they're getting as much money as they can from every 16 ways to Sunday, every which way they can, particularly from the Wall Street. It turns out that Wall Street, 92% of the money, the $33 million that has been spent so far in the 2012 Republican candidate race, 92% of all that cash went to Republicans, and of that, 72% of all the Wall Street money went to Mitt Romney. So the multi-multi-millionaire is getting multi-multi-millions from Wall Street. So tell me that ain't bizarre. So anyway, 866-987-THO. Oh, somebody who wants to argue judicial review. Larry in Danbury, Connecticut. Hey, Larry, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Welcome.
Welcome.
Counselor, make your argument.
Okay, well, I'm not clear if you were speaking about the Administrative Procedures Act. Are you with me on that?
No, it's not what I'm speaking of. What I'm speaking of is the doctrine of judicial review, which was the result of the Marbury case, Marbury versus Madison in 1803, which the Supreme Court asserted that it had the right to strike down laws because they were not consistent with the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Constitution.
Okay, all right. The reason I called was because where veterans for years couldn't get judicial review for the VA decision.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a whole different thing.
They had all these rules and regulations that the Congress spent hours and hours and hours on big thick books, 38 U.S. Code, and then they had an overriding law. But these laws will not be permitted judicial review. And then the question became, what good are these laws if you can't review them in court?
Yeah.
So that's what I was speaking
of. Okay, that kind of judicial review you and I probably agree on. It's a good thing.
Yeah.
And, in fact, this is one of the weird things John Roberts was talking about just a while ago, about how he didn't say because of the Republican filibusters, but that's why there are a whole bunch of federal judgeships that are open right now, because the Republicans are just hoping that they can wait out the Obama presidency, get a Republican in, and reboot it and get more Federalist Society members on the bench and, good conservative judges. But the judicial review that I'm talking about, these twin doctrines, 1803 judicial review, I think it was 1825 judicial supremacy, both came from John Marshall. The first saying that the Supreme Court has the right to review a law passed by Congress and signed by the president and strike it down if they decide that it's unconstitutional, which is not a power that is given to the Supreme Court in the Constitution. And in fact, in the debates during the Constitutional Convention, it was a power that was explicitly the founders took away from the Supreme Court. They did not put it into the Constitution. If anything, they, read Article 3, Section 2, they put the Supreme Court under the regulation of Congress. So Congress, as Dennis Kucinich pointed out in this program about an hour ago, Congress is supposed to be the first among equals. They've become the third among equals, the weakest of the three branches. And then secondly, judicial supremacy, which came a little later when John Marshall again, Thomas Jefferson's sworn political enemy, the high Federalist, the Tea Party or Republican of his day, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, ruled that Supreme Court decisions, if they contradicted anything that Congress did or the President did, were still the law of the land. They got to decide what the law of the land was, not Congress and not the President. And so, anyhow, good try, Larry, or good call, but I'm still looking for some, it's astounding to me because I talk to lawyers, and they, over dinner or whatever, and they'll always say, you know, no, you want judicial review, because if you didn't have judicial review, you wouldn't have had Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. And my response to that is, well, if you didn't have judicial review, you wouldn't have had Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal. You wouldn't have had Dred Scott. Anyway. Colin in New Brunswick, Canada. Hey, Colin, a Canadian calling and talking about Tommy Douglas?
That's correct, yeah.
So
yeah,
tell us all about it.
Well, yeah, a number of years ago, the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, had a contest essentially getting Canadians a vote for who they considered to be the greatest Canadian, and mm-hmm. one of them was Tommy Douglas, and he was the winner.
Wow. Tommy Douglas, the father of Canadian health care, the single-payer health care system that each province has, and generally, now the more or less a federal program, although they're still administered individually by the states, are they not?
But for most people are very happy with it, and he's the most beloved Canadian, in our history, essentially.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know that. I mean, he was the premier of the province. He beat out every prime minister, Pierre Trudeau. He's absolutely beloved in this country, Some people aren't happy with the Medicare system here, but I'm very happy with it. Most people are.
Yeah, that's what I hear. In fact, every time I get some right-wing American on going, oh, all these Canadians are fleeing Canada to come to America to get health care, I get all these calls from Canadians going, no, we're not. We're just fine.
I want to hear a personal story. Like, my mother mm-hmm. had a non-malignant mm-hmm. brain tumor.
Mm-hmm.
This was a number of years ago, and she had surgery to have it removed. And she's completely healthy. She's working, and we were very, very happy with the service that we received.
And she didn't have to wait 5 years to get the treatment.
No, she had to wait a couple of months.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had a 10-pound skull fracture when I was 5, mm-hmm. and I'm completely healthy.
Yeah, yeah. And that's,
I know of no one who has had major complaints.
Right, and the fact of the matter is that if you do have a serious condition, you will get immediate care. In Canada.
Absolutely.
I mean, like the next day, immediate care. If they discover something's really, really wrong.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. I realize, Colin, that it sounds like a stupid question, but no exaggeration, probably 95% of the people who listen to Fox News or watch Fox News and listen to right-wing talk radio believe that if you show up at a doctor's office in Canada with an embolism or something or a heart attack, you will be told, come back in 6 months, the line's too long. I'm not making this up. I mean, these people call into my show, they come on this show, and there's this huge disinformation machine that is constantly running about how terrible Canadian healthcare is. Thanks for calling from New Brunswick, Canada, and setting us straight. I'd appreciate it, Colin. Thank you very much. We'll be back here on the Tom Hartman program, 15 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, and David in Ann Arbor knows about another mandate, this one going all the way back to George Washington's presidency. Stick around for that.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you. No pill's gonna kill my
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Paul in Seattle, in Woodinville, Washington, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, nice to talk to you, first-time caller.
Thanks for listening.
Are we fellow Spartans?
Well, sort of.
Okay. I
went for a little more than a term.
Okay. Anyway, I wanted to talk about something I don't hear about the Health Care Reform Act, and that is this. Nobody argues this. The health care of a nation is on the cost side of the balance sheet. That's what running a nation is.
Right. And at least costs from the point of view of a health insurance company.
Well,
it's a benefit from our end of it.
Right. It costs us. We have to treat illness. And here's the thing. We know what the incidence of illness is. Every insurance company knows that. And we know what the cost is to treat that illness or not to treat it. Every insurance company knows that.
Right.
And we know how many people are in this country. So that's that's the equation. We know exactly what it costs to have health care in this country.
Right.
And the only way you can make money as an insurance company is to avoid paying that cost. And the way you avoid doing that is by not coming up with the, by taking in premiums and not paying for it. And I have personal experience with this. My partner of 17 years was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2002, and Blue Shield canceled her insurance while she was still in treatment. Let me ask you this. Do you think she could buy health insurance at any price?
No.
No. Not any private health insurance at any price, and so eventually got on Washington Basic Health, which she paid for. She had a good job, and she made good money, and so she paid a lot of money for it. But mm-hmm. that wasn't the issue. No one would sell her anything.
Right.
She is recently deceased.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Paul.
You know, this is ridiculous that when she paid into, she had this company for 30 years, paid premiums for it, and as soon as they could find a technicality, they got rid of her, and that's what these companies do.
Yeah. You're absolutely right, and it's a crime, and it should be a crime. It's not a crime. I mean, it's morally a crime. It should be legally a crime. And in another 2 years, it will be a crime. And, Paul, I'm sorry to hear about your partner, but...
When you think about it, it was probably legally actionable.
Yeah.
But when you're sick with cancer, that's not what you're thinking about.
Yep.
That's not something you have energy for.
You're absolutely right. Thanks, Paul, for the call. David in Ann Arbor, Michigan, you wanted to tell us about another mandate?
Yes, sir. If the Supreme Court considers the Second Militia Act of 1792, which demands that you buy your own gun, buy your own ammunition belt, buy your own ammunition, and buy your own backpack, and you must participate if you're 18 to 45.
Right. That was the Militia Act of 1792, and you're right. It was the first mandate, and I think that this one's going to survive that challenge. Congresswoman Barbara Lee is with us. Welcome.
Glad to be with you.
So glad to have you on our program, and thank you for joining us. Let me adjust this camera here to get it. The right shot. And so tell me your takeaway from today's first day of arguments before the Supreme Court of the Affordable Care Act. Now they're calling it Obamacare at the White House. I think that's a great thing. He should embrace it. He should get credit for it. And where this is all going.
I hope the Supreme Court listens to the facts in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And they will conclude, I hope and believe, that this health care law is a law that is constitutional. It is a law that already is helping ensure access to affordable and accessible health care for many, many millions of Americans. And it's so important that people understand that it's going to say it is saving money. It saves costs, and it really reduces the burden on all taxpayers in terms of cost of health care for everyone. And so it's an important law.
It really is. And it's just the start, Congresswoman. I'm curious what your thoughts are about how this country may look in terms of the health care scenario a decade or two decades down the road, because we've been seeing this kind of steady evolution in so many areas. You know, America's over the last... since its creation, it's become a consistently more progressive nation. What's your sense of the direction that healthcare is going?
As a result of this law, I believe the direction is going more toward preventive care, which mm-hmm. ensures that people live healthier lives and live longer,
right.
And that we're able to identify, especially in communities of color, for example, racial and ethnic disparities. You know, diabetes, heart disease, HIV and AIDS,
yeah.
many cardiovascular disease, prostate cancer, all of the diseases that many African Americans and communities of color have been dealing with in a disproportionate way for many years. This law now will help begin to reduce those disparities. It's very important in terms of everyone in this country to receive preventive health care. Our seniors will receive a wellness appointment every year. It will lower their health care costs in terms of prescription drugs. And so it's just a good law that needs to be upheld.
I find it ironic to the point of bizarre that Sarah Palin and some of these other right-wingers, when they learned that there was a requirement for seniors, not a requirement, an option for seniors to have an annual free physical, that became a death panel.
Can you, in the minute we have left, can you just kind of speak to the politics
of
this?
Well, you know, there's been so much misinformation out there, so much. The Tea Party has really led in distorting the facts. And Sarah Palin's one of those individuals who, I don't know for whatever reason, decided that they wanted to try to not tell the truth about this. And to me, that's so disingenuous. This is a serious law. It's a serious right that people should have. We're one of the few industrialized countries in the world that have no health care system for all. So it's a shame and disgrace that the far right tries to distort the facts about what this is really about. It saves us money. It provides access and affordable health care to everyone, each and every American. They deserve that. That's part of the American dream.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee, you are extraordinary. One of my heroes. Heroines. Thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thank
you. Good to be with you.
It's an honor and a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you. We'll be back with more here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with more on the news and your calls right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Washington, D.C., from in the shadow of the Supreme Court, although they have now long ago finished their first day of arguments about the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. With me is Vincent DeMarco, the president of the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative, adjunct assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and the website healthcareforall.com.
Correct.
Tell me about that.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. And what we are is a grassroots organization in Maryland that has succeeded under the leadership of our Governor Martin O'Malley to expand health care to over 300,000 Maryland parents, children, and seniors over the last 5 years. And now we're poised to really implement well the Affordable Care Act. Our governor has taken a lead in making sure that we enact legislation to get that law fully implemented in Maryland in a way that will expand health care to another 400,000 people and make health care more affordable for about all Marylanders. We are very happy about the Affordable Care Act, and we're hopeful that the Supreme Court will see that it would be a bad mistake on their part to pull the rug out from under the millions of young people who are now in their parents' health care because of the Affordable Care Act, the millions of seniors who've gotten rebate checks on their prescription drugs, the young people who can get health care despite pre-existing conditions, and the hundreds of thousands of small businesses who have taken advantage of the tax credits for health care. It would really be a big mistake to pull the rug out from under these people. And precedent for the last 75 years supports the Congress and the President using the Commerce Clause to take care of problems like this.
Sure. Yeah. From civil rights, even before that.
Social Security Act, yes.
Social Security, yeah, exactly. That was the first time the Supreme Court, to the best of my knowledge, did that.
And right. And those laws were attacked at the time. People attacked them vociferously. They appealed to the courts. And now, who would call for repealing the Social Security Act? And I think in a few years,
probably Rick Santorum.
Well, no one is going to get anywhere. But in the future, people are going to look back on the Affordable Care Act the way we look back now on a Social Security Act as a bedrock of our society.
Amen. So your website, healthcareforall.com,
yes.
You said this is the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative, yes. Is a grassroots citizens organization. Maryland is a relatively blue state. Virginia next door is a pretty red state. I don't hear anything like this coming out of Virginia. Are there grassroots groups like yours in other states around the country? Are they generally more successful with the support of a governor like you have, or can they be successful in a state like Florida where you've got the whole establishment stacked against you? What's your advice to people who would like to follow in your footsteps? How do they do it?
Well, our advice is to let people know that the Affordable Care Act helps everyone, because we all benefit when everyone has health care. If someone doesn't have health care and runs up a huge hospital bill, either they don't have health care either because they can't afford it or because they can afford it but don't want to do it, but either way, They run up huge hospital bills that they can't pay for. We all pay for it.
Right.
It's a hidden health care tax. And some of the people we heard today from the Tea Party and others who were saying, I don't want to pay my taxes for other people's health care, we need to tell them you're doing that already. Mm-hmm. And now with the Affordable Care Act, you'll be doing that less. The state of Massachusetts, which, of course, enacted a law that has been a model for the Affordable Care Act, is doing great in three ways. They've expanded health care to 97% of their people. Their insurance premiums are going up less than the rest of the country. And the uncompensated hospital care that is causing this hidden health care tax has decreased dramatically. What we need to let people know is that it's in their interest to expand health care with the Affordable Care Act. Our expansion of health care in Maryland was successful for two reasons. Number one, we ran ads that we called the hidden health care tax, where we talked about this, where we showed people that they benefit when everyone has health care. And second, we found smart funding mechanisms like increasing the tobacco tax and the alcohol tax, measures which reduce teen smoking and underage drinking, to help fund it. So I suggest to our colleagues in other states to do these same things. Number one, educate people that everyone benefits when everyone's covered. And secondly, use smart funding mechanisms like tobacco and alcohol taxes to fund the expansions.
But you're talking almost as if you're a legislator. What if somebody's listening in Phoenix, Arizona, or in Los Angeles, or in Butte, Montana, yeah, or whatever, or in rural Virginia, and they're thinking, this is great, I'd like to become an activist to bring health care to all, to be an advocate for these kind of systems, even taking it further than Obamacare does. What's the first step? Did you? What, how did you guys get this healthcareforall.com? How did you do this?
There's actually a book out about this. It's called The DeMarco Factor, embarrassingly enough.
That's great.
Transforming Public Will into Political Power. And if you go to Amazon.com, and it's written by Michael Perchik, former chairman of the FTC, mm-hmm, who wrote this book that describes a six-step process we engaged in, which resulted in these public health successes. So I would encourage advocates who are looking for that kind of advice to take a look at this book. Just go to Amazon.com and look up the DeMarco Factor. And the six steps are: come up with a smart plan.
Right.
Like
one
that increases tobacco tax or whatever the plan is.
Right.
Second is do some polling to find the political support.
Right.
Third, and this is the key, build a broad-based coalition, including faith community, community leaders, and everyone else. Write a document for groups to sign and spend time reaching out to the public, building this coalition, maybe a few months, maybe a few years. That's the part a lot of people don't do. Fourth is use the media to the hilt. Talk to people like Tom Hartman.
Right.
Get editorials. Use the earned media, paid media where you can. Fifth, make it an election issue. Make candidates take a stand on these issues. And then sixth, take it to the legislature. So many advocates go right from step one to step six without the part in the middle. You really have to educate the public.
Right. And everybody can do that.
Everybody can do it.
There you go. Okay. Doctor, are you Dr.
No.
Just
Vinny.
Just okay. Vinny DeMarco, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. An honor to meet you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Remarkable. And the DeMarco Factor
is
the book.
Yeah, people
can check it out. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Let's see here. Ann in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Ann. Thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, great day to you.
Thank you.
We actually have sun out here today.
The sun just came out here in D.C., too. It's beautiful.
Great.
So, after 2 days of rain.
The thing is that we had a woman on earlier who was talking about her rural health care and the difficulties that they have in getting doctors, especially ones that they don't have to pay an administrative fee.
Yeah, that was in Arizona, yes.
It's one thing that the Obamacare, in quotes, is actually answering a lot of, is because he is putting a huge amount of money towards the education of people, doctors who work in the rural areas. The public health service is being greatly enhanced, so on and so forth. So
that's right. Bernie Sanders' amendment that created 10,000 local health clinics, Doc-in-a-Box outfits all over the country. For example,
exactly.
Many of those going into rural areas.
I was having quite a conversation with one of our local Tea Partiers, and he was going on about the private army that Obama was putting into this act.
Geez.
And so,
it's a private army of doctors. And I can tell you it's a pretty cool thing, because one of my kids has a job in one of those places that was brought into being by these.
So, I can tell you from experience, they are there. Thanks a lot for the call, and I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Billy in Grand Portage, New Mexico. Hey, Billy, what's up?
Hello, this is Grand Portage, Minnesota. Up on
from Minnesota. I'm sorry. I mixed up my M and my N. Minnesota.
And anyway, yeah, and I really like your show, Tom. I listen to it a lot. I like a lot of it. But a couple things I want to bring up. One is I lived in Canada twice. I live on the Canadian border.
Mm-hmm.
And there are hundreds and hundreds who do not like the Medicare system, and many, many go to the United States because it takes too long. It takes 6 months to 18 months sometimes for heart. Many things, and I know hundreds of people that don't like it because of that.
I don't believe you, Billy.
Oh, that's fine.
I've spent more than half my life living within 150 miles of the Canadian border. I've never seen it. I'm sure that there are a lot of people who don't like the system, or let me rephrase that, who have complaints about the system. Do you have any complaints about the American healthcare system?
No,
you have no complaints?
No.
Okay, all right. Well, then, I'm glad you're so happy with it. I think that having 50 million people not having health insurance is a problem. I think having your health insurance company be able to say to you when you get sick and you need a multi-million-dollar surgery or even a multi-hundred-thousand-dollar surgery, sorry, we're not going to insure you anymore. We're going to just stop paying your bills. I think that's wrong. So I have some complaints with our healthcare system. Nina in Chicago. Nina, we have just a little less than a minute. A quick question?
Two things regarding a caller earlier, Reagan, when he passed the law regarding you can't turn somebody away from a hospital for cure.
Right.
What are we supposed to turn people away? That's first. On to the second, regarding the lady that was beaten to death. Okay.
I'm sorry. Say it again.
The lady that was beaten to death with the tire iron.
Yes.
Okay. And, you know, all this talk, you guys talking earlier about Rush Limbaugh putting a woman down, calling her a prostitute, this and that, you know. But we have somebody that was beaten to death. And it was a hate crime because there was a note there.
Sure.
And it just said, like, nothing, you know. And then you have this other case, another tragedy with that kid that was shot, you know. And now we have people putting hoodies on like it's a black Ku Klux Klan.
Right.
And a bounty out for him when the police know where he's at, you know. Let the police do the investigation. And why don't they take that money and try and find that the real person who... that did a hate crime, that we know for sure for now who did a hate crime, and try to find him, because we have some freak out on the street, you know, beating women to death. Okay, we're talking about...
Nina, I'm totally with you. The this poor Iraqi woman who was beaten to death with a tire iron. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour, back with your calls right after this.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back, Tom Harbin here with you. Philip in 84 Pennsylvania watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Philip, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I was discussing Marbury Madison with my cousin yesterday, and he stumped me on this one.
Okay.
He says, okay, what if a law was signed with like a $1,000 poll tax?
Right.
How would democracy correct for that? The only hope you would have would be a judicial review and call it unconstitutional.
Well, what that means is that you are believing that the only reasonable people are judges, and that they're going to be the wise elders and kings and saviors of the nation. And I would submit to you that while that was the perspective that was shared by people like John Adams, Thomas Jefferson had a very different vision and said, no, the people are the wise elders. And if a legislature was to pass a $1,000 poll tax, the people would rise up in the next election and they would throw those bums out of office.
But how could they if they couldn't afford to vote?
Well, I think that there would be a wise enough majority that would do that. No, it's not a matter of hoping. If you look at the history of the United States, what you see is that the Supreme Court has typically, you know, sometimes they lead public opinion, but more often than not, they follow it. Things that get done by virtue of judicial review would have gotten done legislatively sooner or later. and many of the harms that were done by judicial review, like Dred Scott, for example, or Plessy versus Ferguson, probably wouldn't have happened legislatively, at least at the federal level. They might have happened at the state levels, and ultimately they would have gotten resolved. So
you can't imagine any way that any law that could be passed that would so screw up the democratic system that it couldn't correct itself.
That's correct. That is my thesis, and it's based on the assumption that the people en masse, that you know, the vast majority of the people are smarter and
democracy, but I just believe it has to be, you know, if the people can't vote, then it no longer functions, and that's all I would be afraid of.
Well, as I said, I just can't imagine first of all, you probably wouldn't even have to wait for an election. Let's not make it a $1,000 poll tax. Let's make it a $500,000 poll tax. Okay?
Yeah.
So
it would be impossible.
Literally only 300,000 people in the United States would be able to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And so that law gets passed.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is going to happen?
Well,
in the streets.
Revolution, I would imagine. Yeah.
That's right. You're going to have people in the streets. You're going to have protests. You're going to have mass actions. And I'm not talking about, you know, civil war shooting people. I'm talking about just you're going to have massive protests. And the consequence of that will be that the same legislators who passed the law will unpass the law. The people, we have to trust the people. That's the essence of democracy. That was the great American democratic, small d democratic experiment, was can you trust the people? Yeah, we're going to try. And there were people at the time who said, no, you can't. You have to have the Senate that's not elected. It's appointed, as it was until 1919, I think it was. And you have to have a Supreme Court that's not elected. It's appointed. And although they put limits on what the Supreme Court could do, the Supreme Court had to operate under regulations defined by Congress. It's been a long time since Congress defined any regulations to the Supreme Court. I think that they should. And the Supreme Court was not given the power of judicial review. But you know, as you know, took it in the Marbury case. And I just think it's wrong.
I've always felt that, but I've always said, well, it's established law, and I can't imagine any way that it would become unestablished.
Laws get overturned all the time by other laws.
That long, you know, something that's, you know, goes all the way.
Oh, you're
back.
Talking about Marbury.
You know, how do we correct from that at this point? I don't see it happening. Anyway,
I think what happens is that overreach reaches the point where there's backlash. The Supreme Court in the 1930s, when Franklin Roosevelt started helping the United States out of the Great Depression and literally saving the lives of people with the WPA, the CCC, the child labor laws, the Wagner Act, the right to unionize, and in 34, 35, 36, the Supreme Court started striking these laws down as unconstitutional over and over and over again. There was so much public backlash, and so many people were so upset that Franklin Roosevelt came up with this idea. Four or five of the members of the Supreme Court were over 70 years old, and so he proposed legislation, which is authorized by Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. He proposed legislation that said that anybody who was over 70 years old on the Supreme Court only became a justice emeritus, and in aggregate, all the 70-plus-year-olds on the Supreme Court would have one vote. So all five guys would just have one vote. And new people would be brought onto the Supreme Court to make up the missing votes. So right now you've got a Supreme Court with nine people on it. If five of them became a justice of emeritus, you could add four new people, and which is what Roosevelt planned on doing. Now, the right wing just, you know, his opponents just flipped out, and he backed down. Although I just read a very, very good book of the history of that era, and there's a lot of scholars who've looked at this and said if he hadn't backed down, he probably would have succeeded because he had the people with him. I mean, the people were really upset that the Supreme Court was striking down the 40-hour work week, was striking down child labor laws, was, you know, calling all this stuff the, you know, right to individually contract. And so what happened was the composition of the Supreme Court between 1936 and 1937 did not change. But Franklin Roosevelt got reelected in an overwhelming election in 1936, and he got reelected on a campaign platform of "They hate me, and I welcome their hatred." These economic royalists, you know, and that whole rant, and the members of the Supreme Court who he was going to, you know, not replace, but he was going to round up five of them and make them just have one vote. They suddenly got with the program, and the court changed from 36 to 37, and the 1937 court everybody, the same people, started voting the right way, and it was because the voice of the people had been heard. So if the court, which is not even answerable to people in an election, can do that, certainly legislators would do that. So that's why I'm not so concerned about bad laws, because they'll eventually get replaced by good laws. The people will speak. Philip, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We will be back tomorrow with more on the news of the day, the Supreme Court, everything else. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.